she put her arm through his arm, like while they were sitting there smoking, and they spoke Spanish, and they walked off, and that's it. That was it.
One night in April 2011, a man in Denver observed a large barrel emanating flames coming from the back of a bakery. He thought nothing of it at the time, but would soon learn that a teenager was missing from the area, and a man who worked in the bakery was the last person to see her. Kenya Monhey moved from Honduras when she was just 12 years old. Her mother Maria had given birth to her at just 15 years old. A year and 3 months after her birth, Maria came to the United States, leaving Kenya behind with her mother. Shortly after Maria arrived, she met a man named Tony Lee, and from the moment they met, all Maria spoke about was wanting to bring Kenya over to live with them. When that day finally came, Maria and Kenya were ecstatic. She had a brand new stepfather as well, Tony, but he always treated her as if she were his own flesh and blood. In fact, when Kenya was learning to speak English, she asked Tony to define their relationship. He told her that they were stepdaughter and stepfather. Kenya responded, "No, you're my father and I'm your daughter." At 19 years old, Kenya was a crew leader at City Wild, a non-profit that does outdoor experimental education with middle and high school students. She had been a participant of the program before eventually working her way up to crew leader. Kenya loved nothing more than hanging out with the younger students, taking them on camping and rafting expeditions. She was looking forward to learning how to be a rafting guide and was a fantastic role model to those younger than her. Those who knew Kenya described her as sweet and friendly. On the 31st of March 2011, Kenya set out with a group of friends to the nightclub, 24K Lounge, at 14th and Market Street in Denver. Despite being only 19 years old, Kenya was able to get into the nightclub with a fake ID that said she was 21. In the early morning hours, Kenya told her friends that she was going to the bathroom, leaving them with her cell phone, keys and purse on the table. Kenya never returned, and as the nightclub closed for the night, her friends were left wondering what to do. Eventually, they all went home that night, assuming that Kenya must have caught a lift with somebody. The following morning, a friend went over to Maria and Tony's home to hand over her cell phone and purse, only to learn that Kenya hadn't arrived back home that night. Maria and Tony were frantic, and they quickly reported her missing. The first point of investigation for detectives was to release a photograph of Kenya. She was described as standing at 4 feet 11 inches tall and weighing 115 pounds. When she was last seen at the nightclub, she was wearing a black skirt, black jacket, and red high-heeled shoes. Detectives were keen to try and retrace her last known movements and establish whether anybody had actually seen her leave the nightclub that night. Detectives spoke with Johnny Coast, the operations manager at the nightclub. He recollected, "Our staff has confirmed that Kenya was here that evening. She's also been here several times before. We can also tell you that she wasn't drinking." He informed them that during the night, he had seen Kenya dancing with a man. They appeared to be in good spirits and remained in one another's company for several hours. He also said that other members of staff noticed that they had left together through the back door. Detectives scoured through the surveillance footage to try and corroborate Johnny's account of Kenya leaving the nightclub with a man. They were indeed able to find surveillance of her walking down the street with a man. She was barefoot and stumbling, and surveillance captured her outside an apartment complex nearby. Kenya and the man then made their way into the apartment complex and then entered the elevator. However, as the doors began to close, Kenya seemingly had a change of heart. She walked back out of the elevator and back onto the street alone as the man went upstairs to his apartment. The man never followed her, but she could be seen chatting with a group of men who had just been fighting in the lobby. From here, Kenya walked to a nearby hotel and used the bathroom. When she came back outside, she returned to the apartment where another unknown man ushered her inside. They appeared to talk for several moments before Kenya walked off outside alone. From here, she seemingly vanished. On the 7th of April, detectives appealed to the public for information. They also declared that they were making Kenya's disappearance their top priority. They feared for the worst, as it had now been 1 week since Kenya was last seen, and she hadn't been in contact with anybody since that night at the nightclub. Police spokesman Matt Murray stated, "This is a missing person case, and until we have information that indicates it's something other than that, that's how we're going to treat this case." Detectives also called in the assistance of the FBI Safe Streets Task Force and experts from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Meanwhile, Kenya's mother, Maria Lee, chatted with the media at her home in suburban Aurora. She solemnly commented, "I feel like they took my baby daughter, my heart, my soul, my everything. I just feel like running out of this house to go and find her." After detectives appealed to the public for information about Kenya's whereabouts, darkness descended over Denver. That night, a body was discovered in an open area near South Chambers Road and East Yale Avenue. Detectives promptly descended on the scene and secured it. They then guarded the scene overnight so that they could continue the investigation in daylight. While at first there was an intense fear that the body was Kenya, detectives quickly discounted this and announced that the body wasn't hers. The body would be identified as 73-year-old Gerald Schwartzman, who had been shot dead. The search for Kenya continued, and as each day passed, concerns grew further and further. On the 9th of April, detectives released cell phone photographs of Kenya taken before she disappeared, hoping that it would refresh someone's memory. Kenya's parents were beside themselves with worry, and on the 13th of April, Maria and Tony held a press conference. They described Kenya as sweet and smart, but very tough, and shared their belief that somebody was keeping her from contacting them. They pleaded with the public for information, no matter how small or insignificant it may have seemed. Maria and Tony were frantic with worry, and Tony decided to look through Kenya's cell phone for any evidence that could point them in the right direction. There was a text message from an unknown phone number that was sent to Kenya the morning after she disappeared. It read, "Hey, this is Travis, the guy who gave you a ride last night in the creepy van. Did you get home?" Tony immediately called the unknown number and was greeted by 31-year-old Travis Forbes. Travis told Tony, and later detectives, that he had been out celebrating his sister's birthday downtown with his friend, Edward Fajardo, on the night that Kenya disappeared. At about 2:30 a.m., Travis dropped Edward off at Hyatt Regency Hotel, which was near the nightclub that Kenya had been at. After dropping him off, he observed a young woman outside chatting with a homeless man. She was wearing a hoodie and a miniskirt, and she appeared to be intoxicated. Travis said that when he approached her to check if she was all right, she wrapped her arm around his. It was Kenya. He recalled how she had a thick accent and said that she was upset after breaking up with her boyfriend. He said to detectives, "She was very inebriated and emotional, and I was just trying to figure out where she had come from, who her friends were." Kenya climbed into Travis's van with him as he tried to figure out a way to help her. She used his cell phone to call her own cell phone, but nobody answered it. She told him that she had been at the nightclub with her friends, so they drove over there. However, it was closed, so Travis said he asked her where she lived. He said that he realized her home was just a couple of blocks away from the bakery where he worked in Aurora, so he offered to give her a lift. Travis recollected. She was really emotional, really upset. She was also concerned about her father seeing her in such an intoxicated state. From here, Travis travelled in the direction of Aurora, when Kenya spotted a Kokono gas station at Spear Boulevard and Pennsylvania Street. She asked him to stop so that she could get some cigarettes. When they pulled up, however, the gas station was closed, and Travis said that Kenya became upset again. Travis started to drive away to continue on to Kenya's house when he said she spotted a man walking down the street. He was smoking a cigarette, and Kenya asked Travis to stop the car. According to Travis, the man identified himself as Dan. He had a lip piercing and was baby-faced. Kenya immediately jumped out of Travis's van, ran over to this unknown man named Dan, and put her arm around his.
She put her arm through his arm, like, while they were sitting there smoking. And they spoke Spanish. And they walked off. And that's it. That was it. And I went home.
And that's the last you see of her?
Yes. If she had made the choice to go back home or to get in my van, I would have taken her home. Like, I would not. I mean, and if I felt any sort of weirdness about her walking over that guy, I would have done something.
The last time that Travis saw her was when he drove away and saw her walking off with this man. He recollected. She walked off with no coercion, under her free will. Kenya had given Travis her phone number, and he said that the next day he texted her to check if she was okay, but he never heard back from her. Once Travis came forward, rumors began circulating that he was somehow involved in Kenya's disappearance. After all, he was the last person to see her alive. Travis commented in the media, "Until they find this girl, it's going to weigh on me. I do feel responsible. I chose not to care, to be indifferent." Since Travis was the last person to see Kenya alive, detectives were keen to corroborate his story. They went to Debbie's Bakery and Cafe where he worked, around the corner from where Kenya lived. The owner of the bakery informed the detectives of something peculiar. On the morning of the 2nd of April, when she went to the bakery, she noticed that the surveillance camera had been switched off. She played it back and found that the last image captured on the camera was of Travis, as he entered the office and turned the machine off at 7:22 p.m. on the 1st of April. Curiously, he was wearing latex cleaning gloves that went all the way to his elbows, and he wasn't scheduled to be working that day. The owner said that she had sometimes allowed him to sleep overnight at the bakery, however. When detectives reviewed the tape, they found Travis at 7:10 p.m. wheeling a cart to the back door of the bakery with a large white cooler on top. The cooler was bound with black duct tape. Travis then rolled the cooler inside the bakery, just 24 minutes after he had texted Kenya, asking whether she had gotten home safely. Detectives then learned from a man who worked nearby. He said that when he was leaving his store at around 8:30 p.m. that night, he saw two or three men behind the bakery burning something in a 55-gallon metal drum. The next day, between 2 p.m. and 3 p.m., the same man saw Travis park behind the bakery. He was cleaning the inside and outside of a large cooler in the back of his van. This aroused suspicions, so detectives removed a number of items from the bakery, including a cooler. Detectives also obtained a search warrant for Travis's white 2000 Ford van, which he said he had driven Kenya to the gas station in. They wanted to examine the vehicle for any evidence, including clothing, fibers, hair, bodily fluids or fingerprints. Meanwhile, they spoke with Travis's friend, Edward, who he was with the night Kenya disappeared. He told detectives that on the night that Travis picked Kenya up, there was a black rubber mat covering the floor of the cargo area in his van. However, when detectives searched the van, there was a rug there instead, and it looked and smelled new. Then on the 5th of April, the owner of Debbie's informed detectives that a white igloo cooler was missing from the bakery. Even more bizarre, her brand new fire extinguisher had a broken gauge. Suspicions were certainly mounting. But detectives were keen to stress that while they were investigating Travis's story, he wasn't considered a suspect in Kenya's disappearance. Kenya's family chatted with the media once more, and her mother Maria said that they were still hopeful that she was alive. She commented, "Day by day, God has given me strength, and I know God will bring her back." She was holding deeply to her faith to help her get through the horrific ordeal of her daughter being missing. While the items removed from Travis's car were being examined, detectives began looking into his background. They found some very ominous information. Detectives discovered that Travis had a criminal history that included convictions for unusual and at times violent behaviour towards women. When he was 17 years old, he broke into 16 homes and businesses in Fort Collins and stole more than $15,000 worth of money and merchandise. When his home was searched for these items, detectives found several pairs of women's underwear that he had stolen. These included three that belonged to a woman, and he had poked holes in them and then marked them with her first initial. He was sentenced to 9 years in prison for two felony burglary counts but was admitted to military boot camp. Travis was then kicked out of the program for numerous rule violations and was placed on probation. Trouble only continued to follow Travis while on probation. In 1998, he was arrested for criminal harassment, breaking a rule carrying a knife in 1999 and violating curfew 43 times. He was then sent to community corrections. Then in 2004, two women were out jogging when they passed Travis and a woman near a parked car. As they passed, Travis hurled rocks at them, and as they turned to confront him, he yelled, "What are you going to do, you stupid bitch?" The woman who was with Travis at the time, Olga, said to police when they arrived that he only got that way when he was drunk. He was convicted of third-degree assault. According to Travis, he committed these offences when he was addicted to drugs, and he maintained that he was no longer that same man. He said that he had completely turned his life around, and in a way he certainly had. After this stint in prison, Travis created a gluten-free granola bar, and he worked closely with coffee shops and health stores in supplying his product. He rented a space in the bakery in Aurora to make the bars. But still, he was now a person of interest in a missing person case, and his criminal history was certainly compelling. The woman who owned the bakery, Monica Poole, came to his defence as well. She said that Travis often used the cooler to carry his granola bars into the store, and Travis said the only reason that there was duct tape on the cooler was because the latch had broken. Travis chatted with the media once all of this was made public, and he made a very cryptic comment. He stated, "There are other things about that night that will come out, but I had nothing to do with that girl who is missing. I don't want to incriminate myself. With Colorado's three strikes laws, I could get a habitual offender charge." However, Travis refused to elaborate on what else he had gotten up to that night. Things he said could make him appear guilty. As the search for Kenya continued, a candlelight vigil was held for her on the 25th of April. Despite the windy and wet weather, people came out in droves and tried to shield their candles from the gusts. It got underway at Wyatt Edison Charter School, where Kenya had been a student. The community had really bonded together to try and find Kenya. A Facebook page was set up and countless people printed out missing person posters and stuck them across the city. In early May, the world would come to learn that Travis wasn't really the changed man that he had claimed to be. On the 6th of May, Travis was arrested in Austin, Texas, but not in connection with Kenya's disappearance. He was arrested for car theft. Travis had stolen a car from a former girlfriend and had then driven to Austin, where he had rented a house. He arrived at his new place and offered his brand new roommates some gluten-free granola bars. Travis was unaware that the car he had stolen had been reported missing and had been traced to his new home in Austin, U.S. Marshals and Austin police, armed with assault rifles, swept in and immediately arrested him. His new roommates were completely unaware that he was a person of interest in a missing person case in Denver. One roommate, Elliot Hallmark, said that Travis had contacted him through Craigslist to ask if he could rent a room. According to Travis, he was an artist, and his landlord had evicted him after he spilled paint on the garage floor. This was a complete fabrication. After Elliot agreed that Travis could move in, he couldn't get in contact with him. When Travis finally reached out, he first of all told Elliot that he had met a drunk woman who stole his cell phone, and then claimed that he threw his cell phone in a lake. Now detectives in Denver were completely unaware that Travis had arranged to move to Austin, which only increased the cloud of suspicion that he was under. It appeared as though he was attempting to flee the investigation, but the car theft charges were ultimately dropped. The search for Kenya in Denver persisted, with no signs of letting up. It had been 72 long days since her disappearance, and her family's home had transformed into a shrine dedicated to her. A wall in the living room displayed a collection of Kenya's photographs, serving as a constant reminder of her absence. In the midst of their anguish, Kenya's family agreed to let the Denver Post into their home. Tony, who was overwhelmed with grief, expressed, "This is pure hell. You can't get away from it for one second of the day." Tony remained determined, maintaining the Facebook page titled, "Help Us Find Kenya," and working to raise a reward fund. Currently standing at $2,000, which was offered by Crime Stoppers, the family hoped to increase the amount, aiming to entice individuals with potential information to come forward. The past 72 days had taken an unimaginable toll on the family. Sleepless nights filled with worry had become their norm, as they grappled with the unknown fate of Kenya. As for birthdays, they were no longer celebrated. Maria and Tony adamantly believed that Kenya would never have left the bar without her cell phone, nor would she have willingly entered a stranger's van. Their deepest fear was that Kenya had been drugged that night, as it was the only explanation they could find to reconcile her inexplicable behaviour that night with the daughter that they knew and loved. Merely a month later, Travis would find himself once again entangled in a criminal situation. On the 12th of July, Travis was arrested after breaking into an apartment in Fort Collins and beating and sexually assaulting the female occupant, Lydia Tillman. Travis had left Lydia for dead, but not before pouring bleach over her and then setting fire to her apartment. Lydia had managed to hurl herself from a second-story window and survived the ordeal. Travis was charged on suspicion of attempted first-degree murder, first-degree assault, arson, vehicle theft, and sexual assault. His bail was set at $350,000. Denver police spokesman Sonny Jackson commented, "We have a missing person case. We have interviewed him a couple of times, but he has never been named as a suspect. We still have a missing person case." The suspicions against Travis were mounting even further. It was evident that he was more than capable of violence, and Kenya's family begged him to provide them with information. Tony commented, "We want to know where Kenya is, and we think he knows. I want him to man up and talk. Until he does that, we're stuck on April 1st, 2011. Tony said that until now he had been reluctant to point the finger at Travis, but now with this arrest, he was absolutely horrified. He stated, "It's the same nightmare. I'm glad the girl is alive. I'm sure that was not his intention." The fact that Travis had lit Lydia's apartment on fire reminded Tony of the barrel burning incident. As mentioned earlier, somebody had seen men burning something in a barrel behind the bakery the day after Kenya disappeared. Tony believed that there were three or four other people involved, possibly helping to dispose of Kenya's body. Despite the similarities in the cases, detectives announced that there were no suspects in Kenya's disappearance, and that there was no known connection between that case and Lydia's assault. Meanwhile, Lydia's family released a statement to keep the public informed on her condition. It read in part, "Lydia continues to fight for her life just as she did the night she was brutally attacked. Her strength and courage has made a difference in the world. She's a hero. Lydia's loving spirit is what makes her special to all who know her." Lydia would eventually recover from the attempt on her life, but she had suffered a head injury and stroke, leaving her with a lifetime of physical and emotional scars. She was left unable to speak and underwent intensive rehabilitation and speech, occupational and physical therapies. She was lucky to escape with her life.
A stranger followed me home. I was walking home from the fireworks in Fort Collins. And he, as far as we can piece together, pushed me into my home. I can't talk about much about the actual night because I don't remember anything. Often, when people have strokes, they don't remember before or after. I think that is the case in me, in my case. But also, that and the sheer amount of trauma I experienced in one night was just too much for my brain to handle.
Back in Denver, Krista Williams and The Rock boxing owners, Tracy and Tasha Morris, announced they were doing a fundraiser to help build the Crime Stoppers Fund and promote awareness to the vulnerability that women face. They conducted self-defense classes and the proceeds went towards the reward fund. As these classes were ongoing, Travis saw a potential to make some money from behind bars. He wrote a letter to the Denver Post asking how much they would pay him for an interview. In another letter, he brazenly wrote, "The dark is barbarous, the primal wilderness. It's the source of birth, pain, passion. It's destructive and creative at the same time. We've been estranged from the dark. We miss it. We miss its healing violence that rips us apart and remakes us." This wasn't Travis's own words, but instead a section from War Stuff, a science fiction book by M.M. Buckner. The Post made no financial offer, but attempted to set up a meeting nevertheless. Travis failed to show up, but within days he would begin talking. But this time, it was two detectives. On the 7th of September 2011, Travis Forbes told detectives that he was ready to speak to them. But first, he wanted to reach a plea agreement. He was afraid of going to prison and being labelled a sex offender.
"I want to go to prison without being labelled as a sex offender."
"Okay. What else?"
"That's it. That's it."
"You'll confess to everything if you go to prison without being labeled a sex offender. Is that what you're saying? You're mad enough
yes.
to that?"
"Yes. Yes, that's what I'm saying."
Once that was secured, he informed detectives that Kenya was dead and that he had killed her. He said that once Kenya was in his van, he sexually assaulted her after she passed out from drinking. However, during the assault, Kenya regained consciousness and she began to struggle. Travis Forbes responded by strangling her to death. After making the confession, Travis was only concerned with himself, telling the detectives, "Now I will spend the rest of my life in prison being raped. I will be raped." He then cryptically stated, When everything comes to light, it's going to be horrific. Horrendous. The detectives asked whether there were more victims, and Travis said that there was, but he refused to elaborate any further. However, towards the end of the interview, Travis commented, "There's only one, and it happened a long, long time ago." Travis Forbes then detailed to detectives what he had done with Kenya's body. He said that he had buried her in Keensburg, around 40 miles from Denver.
"I wanted to bury her either next to some water or next to some trees."
"Why is that?"
"Because that's where I would like to be buried. If somebody had killed me, I would hope that they would bury me next to something nice. They just dump me in some dumpster."
"So you find this spot. Why did you pick there?"
"Because of the trees."
"Okay. And you, how long do you think you dug for?"
"It wasn't very long. I was actually surprised. I was worried that it was so late that I wouldn't have enough time."
"Okay."
"But I dug that hole fast."
"Were you actually inside the hole?"
"Yeah."
"And that's why you were able to tell me that it went shoulder depth?"
I left my credit card inside the hole."
"Why'd you do that?"
"It's not that I wanted to get caught. And it wasn't like I was trying to brag that I did it. Because I knew that if it was ever going to be found, holy shit, that body credit card. And those credit cards have embroidered lettering on them. I just figured it was right. I figured that if you found the body, that I should be caught."
According to Travis, he decided to come clean because he believed that he had accidentally dropped his credit card in the grave where he had buried Kenya. That, and because of her family's determination to learn the truth of what happened to her. After the confession, Travis took detectives to the area. Here, they recovered Kenya's body from a shallow grave between trees in an area near Interstate 76 and Weld County Road 53. She was taped in a fetal position and draped with a plastic tarp. Travis Forbes was subsequently charged with Kenya's murder. The news was absolutely crushing to her loved ones, and Tony commented, "I've prepared myself for this day. It didn't work. There's no way you can prepare yourself for something like this." They had spent more than 5 months waiting for answers, and as Maria said, "Yesterday, I finally got the truth. I know I have an angel in heaven." It was revealed that after Travis was arrested and when detectives searched the computer at the bakery where he worked, they found that he had been researching missing person websites. Detectives now wanted to establish whether he was somehow connected to other missing women in the area. It certainly seemed plausible given the other attack on Lydia. While that was ongoing, Travis was charged with the first-degree murder of Kenya. While the investigation had been ongoing, detectives also learned about some other strange behaviour from Travis the night that Kenya vanished. The evening after her disappearance, an employee had found him standing on top of a large walk-in freezer in the back room of the bakery. He appeared to be retrieving something, but he waited until all of the other employees had left to continue. The same employee later found power tools in a toolbox left next to the freezer. Nearby, she came across a Lowe's Home Improvement Store receipt, which showed purchases for 1x4s and a sheet of plywood. After the owner of the bakery, Monica, was made aware that somebody was spotted burning something, she had asked Travis if it was him. He confirmed that it was, but he claimed that he was burning marijuana. According to Monica, she now believed that Travis was burning evidence. That same day, Monica had observed a large gash on Travis's arm. He claimed that he was attacked by a homeless man while sleeping in his car. Towards the end of the month, Travis Forbes shuffled into court where he pleaded guilty to the first-degree murder of Kenya. He stood before the microphone and sobbed. "It was a mistake. I didn't plan it. I took a life. For the people that knew me, I have to say, remember me, please. Remember me as I was, not the monster I became." Kenya's loved ones were given the opportunity to speak. And her mother Maria said that Travis had robbed the entire family of their dreams. She showed Judge Shelley Gilman pictures of Kenya from her high school graduation. and referred to her as Menina, Spanish for my little girl. Maria said that Kenya had been looking forward to getting her own apartment and starting college. In Spanish, she said, I have always been thinking that my little girl was going to come back. I have an angel in heaven, and I know I will see her again someday. I hope that he seeks and asks forgiveness to God. Tony spoke next, and he addressed Travis Forbes. He asked him why he had to take things to the next level and kill Kenya after he got what he wanted. Judge Shelley Gilman then sentenced Travis Forbes to life in prison. He had also been offered a plea agreement in Lydia's case. The following day, he returned to court, where he pleaded guilty to attempted first-degree murder in exchange for a sentence of 48 years plus 5 years parole. At the court hearing, Travis was allowed to speak. He said that somewhere deep down, he was messed up and evil. He said that he had picked Lydia randomly and said he was glad that she survived, as there would have been more victims had she not. Kenya's friends and family attended the court hearing to offer Lydia and her loved ones support. Lydia's mother, Sharon, had written a victim impact statement that was read aloud by her husband, William. She stated, "No punishment is enough for you." Lydia herself had written a statement, but she still had difficulty speaking, so William read hers aloud as well. She poignantly stated, "Travis Forbes, you caused me no harm. My spirit and my soul, in my mind, remains untouched." The sentencing phase was scheduled for later, but Travis said to the judge that he didn't want to attend. He stated, "I've already been sentenced to life. Why should I be here for 48 years? As he was led back to jail, he looked back into the crowded courtroom, which included his parents, and said, "I'm sorry." Following the sentence, Maria and Tony announced that they were establishing a foundation dedicated to helping women avoid dangerous situations and aiding the families of victims of violent crimes. Tony also spoke out about the terrifying case and said he wanted it to serve as a warning to other women about the perils of trusting strangers. In October, there was an unexpected development in the case, when 23-year-old Kerry Humphrey was arrested in connection with Kenya's murder. Humphrey was Travis's former girlfriend, and detectives accused her of lying in the investigation. She had given Travis a fake alibi for the time during which he was killing and burying Kenya. She told detectives that he was at her home from 3 a.m. until 8:30 a.m., around the time that Kenya was being killed. This alibi was blown to pieces by Travis's phone records, which showed that he was nowhere near Humphrey's home at the aforementioned time. She was released on a personal recognizance bond. The following week, Travis Forbes was sentenced to an additional 48 years behind bars for the attack on Lydia. In July the following year, Humphrey pleaded guilty to perjury, attempting to influence a public official, and 2 counts of false reporting to authorities. She was sentenced to 2 months in jail. Despite an exhaustive investigation into Travis Forbes' claims that there were more victims, detectives were never able to find any evidence that he had killed anybody else. But the United States is expansive, and Travis Forbes was something of a transient person. He had lived in various places over his years, and it is very well possible that there are more victims out there still seeking justice. There is a saying that wolves can lurk in sheep's clothing. This is entirely true for the tragic case of Kenya Monet. At first, Travis Forbes had presented himself as a good Samaritan, somebody wanting to help her get back home safe and sound. The truth, however, was much more sinister, and once she was alone in his van, he showed his true colours. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my newest supporters up on Patreon, Jessica and Phoenix. The support up on there seriously goes such a long way, and I genuinely am eternally grateful. If you'd like to support the show up on Patreon, the link is in the show notes, or alternatively, you can just search for Morbidology on the Patreon app or on their website. In exchange for your support, I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, behind the scenes, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card and some merch. You can also request a case for me up on Patreon to cover on the show. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.